loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou, and joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, President Trump announced his missile defense review today at the Pentagon. This includes 20 new ground-based interceptors, but also a space-based missile defense layer as the Trump administration pushes ahead with its dangerous militarization of outer space. Next, American citizen and journalist Marzia Hashmi has been detained and held by the FBI since Sunday. She is not charged with any crime, but is being held because she is a, quote, material witness. Hashmi is an anchor for Press TV, an Iranian news outlet, and was detained at the airport when she flew to the U.S. to visit her children and work on a documentary about the Black Lives Matter movement. Then it's time again for our regular weekly segment, Veterans for Peace, where we'll discuss contemporary issues of war and peace that affect veterans, their families, the country, and the world. And then two Democrats and two Republicans introduced a bill yesterday that would ban sales of U.S. technology like phone chips to Chinese companies ZTE and Huawei. Despite ongoing negotiations between U.S. and Chinese trade officials, the campaign to stop China's economic rise continues. And finally, this week, mainstream media exploded over meetings between President Trump and Russian President Putin that took place without a U.S. translator. But this is not without precedent. We'll take a look at the history of presidential diplomacy. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to President Trump's announcement today about the so-called missile defense review. Trump spoke at the Pentagon announcing this new program. This includes 20 new ground-based interceptors, but also a space-based missile defense layer as the Trump administration pushes ahead with its dangerous militarization of outer space. We're joined from Old Westbury, New York, by Professor Carl Grossman. Professor Grossman is a full professor of journalism at the State University of New York at Old Westbury. He is also the author of 6 books and the host of the nationally aired television program focused on environmental, energy, and space issues. Carl Grossman, welcome back.
A pleasure to be back.
Is this an important day, Donald Trump's appearance at the Pentagon?
Yeah, absolutely. And you couple it with Trump's push for a space force, a separate arm of the U.S. military, a space force. This, adds a further dimension to what could easily happen. What you cited was, I think, the key to this missile defense review, which he outlined today at the Pentagon, and that's space-based interceptors. What this review talks about is a study of having rockets up there in space, which would be triggered by a system of kind of intelligence apparatuses to sense whether any kind of missile has been launched by a would-be enemy. And then from space, a laser would be, or a rocket would be shot down to Earth to try to, this is what they're talking about at this moment, to destroy that missile.
Carl Grossman is our guest. Gosh, I mean, it sounds like Star Wars, the movie, but of course it also sounds like the original thing that Ronald Reagan laid out in that nationally televised speech that created such a furor in the United States, but also huge degree of alarm and fear inside the Soviet Union and among the peoples of the Soviet Union, the Strategic Defense Initiative, or what was popularly known as Star Wars. The U.S. had no capability to do such a thing then, although Reagan could sort of lay out this vision of space-based missile defense shields, the next generation. Is it more possible now? Obviously, a lot's happened in the last 35 years regarding technology. Is the militarization of outer space and the capacity technologically now present so that this dream of or nightmare of outer space war can actually be realized?
I think really it could have in certain ways always been realized. Let me perhaps provide some background as how I got into this, and it goes way back over 30 years ago. I was reading some government documents about launches in 1986. This is back in 85, talking about launches by two space shuttles in 86 of plutonium-fueled space probes. And I filed a Freedom of Information Act request with NASA and the Department of Energy and the various national laboratories involved, asking what would occur if one of these shuttles with aboard a plutonium-fueled space probe blew up on launch or in the lower atmosphere, the upper atmosphere, fell back from orbit and so forth. And it took almost a year to get information. And the claim by NASA, the Department of Defense and so forth, Department of Energy and so forth, was the likelihood of a catastrophic shuttle accident, 1 in 100,000, no big concern. And then January of 1986, the Challenger blew up on launch, and its next mission, I had found out through my Freedom of Information Act journey, was to be one of these nuclear missions in May of 86. And then I kept probing as to why use nuclear on these space probes. In fact, there's a space probe called Juno, which now 2 years ago reached Jupiter with a solar power, providing the onboard electricity and so forth. And from there, I got into, so it's a kind of a roundabout route, I got into the weaponization, the militarization of space, and the fact that the Pentagon has been for decades interested in, I mean, it actually goes back to before Reagan, battle platforms, which would be nuclear-powered. I mean, how do you shoot a rocket or shoot a laser down from under this new missile defense review plan back to Earth? You need energy up there, and what the documentation I got was that what they were considering was actual reactors or super plutonium systems on battle platforms, providing the energy for lasers and hypervelocity guns and particle beams and so forth. In any case, the end of all this was I wrote a book called Weapons in Space about this issue. I did some television documentaries about this issue, and I've been on the story, if you want to call it a story, ever since. So my point here is that the framework, the blueprint for weaponizing space has always been part of the thinking of the Pentagon, and it, in one way or the other, it could have been made a reality. However, Barack Obama was not crazy. In fact, he was quite against weapons in space. Clinton was, well, in the middle on the issue. The Bushes were for it, but it didn't get anywhere because of political will. Now, with Trump as president and with Pence as vice president, who Trump recently made the chairman of the National Space Council, now we have the political will to do it. And they've been thinking about it and planning for it for years, the U.S. military. And now with Trump and Pence, in one way or the other, it can become a reality.
Professor Carl Grossman is our guest. I want to mention, Professor Grossman, that back in 1986, when the Challenger blew up, just seconds after takeoff in Florida, maybe 90 seconds, I can't remember exactly, I saw your articles. I was writing derivative articles based on your articles. This was in February, I think, or maybe March, but it was right after the Challenger. And you had made the argument based on your Freedom of Information Act find that the next shuttle would have been the one carrying this plutonium load as an energy source because it was a further probe. And that if it had blown up as the Challenger did, it could have dispersed the amount of plutonium over the eastern seaboard and over Florida such that hundreds of thousands of people would have actually died by mistake, in other words, not as a matter of war. I think I'm right about that. That's what you're referring to, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, as to hundreds of thousands, we don't know. It would depend as to how the plutonium would have been dispersed. The issue with plutonium as a toxic substance is if it ends up as dust, if it's in an accident, pulverized as dust, and it falls out, and people breathe it in their lungs, just a speck of a millionth of a gram of plutonium in one's lung
will kill you.
Is a fatal dose. An issue here, too, I'd like to point out is the miscalculations all along. Like I mentioned, how the odds I was given by NASA and the Department of Energy of a catastrophic accident on launch by a shuttle, was 1 in 100,000. Well, that was changed a few months later from 1 in 100,000 to 1 in 76. 1 in 76. And if you look at the shuttle program, that was two shuttles that blew up. 150 launches, two catastrophes.
Yeah, that's 1 out of 76. Carl Grossman, we have 2 minutes left. Here's what Donald Trump said today. Our goal is simple: to ensure that we can detect and destroy any missile launched against the United States anywhere, anytime. I will accept nothing less for our nation than the most effective cutting-edge missile defense system. If he succeeded at that pledge, if the Pentagon succeeded, that would mean the enemy's missiles could be destroyed. That would take away what's called mutually assured destruction in the event of a nuclear war. The whole idea here is that the U.S. could fight and win a nuclear war with this technology, thus making nuclear war actually more real, more possible. 90 seconds left.
Well, you know, we can discuss how many people could have ended up with fatal doses of cancer if there would have been an accident involving a shuttle in one of these plutonium fuel space probes. But if what the U.S. is heading towards, and I think this is what we clearly would be heading towards with a space force and interceptors and so forth in space, are nuclear-powered battle platforms. You go right back to the Reagan plan and concepts before that. And if there would be a shooting war involving nuclear reactors above our heads, some of which would end up getting destroyed, there's no question that lots and lots, and we're talking about huge numbers of people, could be killed. And just furthermore, what Trump is pushing towards is like his attempt to negate the international nuclear arms deal, to negate the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, which sets space aside for peaceful purposes.
Really ominous. And what Carl Grossman, Professor Grossman, is telling us is that even short of a war, the danger would be ever present. And should there be a war, even if the military planners feel that they can take out the enemy's missiles, the likelihood is we'd have nuclear poison raining down on us just as a consequence of the war itself, whether the U.S. Is able to block missiles anyway. Anyway, we are out of time. This is something very, very bad, and it's something that's actually happening. We were joined from Old Westbury, New York, by Professor Carl Grossman. He's a full professor of journalism at the State University of New York College of at Old Westbury. He is also the author of 6 books and the host of a nationally aired television program focused on environmental, energy, and space issues. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. American citizen and journalist Marzeh Hashemi has been detained and held by the FBI since Sunday. She is not charged with any crime, but is being held because she is a, quote, material witness, close quote. Hashemi is an anchor for Press TV, an Iranian English language news outlet. She was detained at the airport where she flew to the United States to visit her children and work on a documentary about the Black Lives Matter movement. That was in St. Louis. We are joined from New York by Glenn Ford. Glenn is the executive director of Black Agenda Report. Glenn Ford, welcome back.
Thanks for the invitation.
You know, we talked about this yesterday. We're talking about it today. We're going to continue to talk about it. This is an egregious miscarriage of justice against this woman. She's a U.S. citizen. She's being held as a material witness. It makes me remember back to the early days after 9/11 when then FBI Director Robert Mueller rounded up thousands of Muslims and Arab Americans and South Asians and held them for months as material witnesses. Again, that sort of absolves the government of the rules and regulations associated with arresting people where the Fourth Amendment applies. Suddenly, Fourth Amendment out the window. Anyway, this is an important case.
Yeah, the government seems to use this material witness law as a kind of black hole to suck up whoever they want to. Whether they have any actual material evidence against that person or anyone else or not.
Yeah. Glenn Ford is our guest here. I mean, her son is the one who has let us, the public, we the people, know that she's being held as a material witness. Glenn Ford, she was on her way to St. Louis to do a documentary about the Black Lives Matter movement. Obviously, if she was involved in criminal activity or associating with criminal activity, she wouldn't get on a plane, on a civilian airliner, come to St. Louis in a public way, make a movie about the Black Lives Matter movement. You can't draw any other conclusion, I'm certainly not, other than the fact that this is part of the U.S. government's war against alternative media and also the Trump administration's war against Iran. What's your take?
Well, as her son explains, this trip to the United States is totally routine. It's what she does. She's been in Iran for about 25 years, but she comes back about once a year and she visits family. And during that time, since she's a working person, she usually does documentary work in the United States, but she encapsulates it into that usually one visit per year. So she was just doing her routine thing. I'm sure that they knew she was coming because she does this regularly. I was speculating immediately that she may have been picked up regarding the U.S. sanctions against Iran. It's similar to the way the United States caused the Chinese electronics firm executive to be arrested in Canada. I'm not sure that that is the case with Ms. Hashemi. Certainly, it would be in character for the Trump administration to arrest a person like Hashemi, who is black and works for the Iranians, because that's the kind of thing that the Trump people think impresses their base. That's the kind of people that the Trump folks think their base likes to see beat up on. But it also, as you said, fits in with the general, and this is not just the Trump land domain, the general hysteria that's been whipped up against all alternative voices, against all voices of dissent in this country. We're now told that it's because of Russia that Americans don't like each other, that Americans have racial problems, that Americans are dissatisfied with the economic situation in the country. The Russians have done all of this. And so those voices of dissent are immediately now labeled as being dupes of Moscow. Black Agenda Report was put on one of the first lists, black lists that were put out in this current new Cold War by the prop or not shadowy organization given a platform by the Washington Post. I'm sure that that blacklist is a lot longer now than it was 2 years ago.
That's the voice of Glenn Ford. He's with Black Agenda Report. We're talking about the arrest of Marzia Hashemi, a news anchor, a presenter for Press TV, English language TV. She's the host of The Debate, the show The Debate. Many people in the United States have been on The Debate. Many people watch The Debate. She's very, very well known in the United States and around the world. She's a public personality. Just if we could, I want to help our audience here in Washington, D.C. Again, I know everybody is being sort of overcome with the anti-Russia, anti-China, and especially anti-Iran narrative. And thus, people, if they're not thinking, if they're not reading carefully, if they're not having a skeptical eye towards the news, they may think, well, if there's this much smoke, there must be some fire. There must be something she did wrong. But the fact of the matter is, by doing this, the Trump administration is sending a message that is unmistakable. If we thought about it and put the shoe on the other foot, just think of if there was a Russian person in the United States or an Iranian person in the United States, and they were working, say, I don't know, for CNN or CBS, and they arrive back either in Moscow or Tehran, and the moment they step off the plane, the secret police from Iran or from Russia rush in, hold them, don't charge them, hold them as a material witness. Their families don't know what's going on. I mean, the hue and cry would be blaring. It would be an example that Russia and Iran are, you know, countries that disregard human rights and disregard the rights of journalists. And yet, Glenn Ford, Black Agenda Report's talking about it. We're talking about it. Alternative media are talking about it. But the same corporate-owned media, I don't know, it's pretty muted, except to say, there must be a problem here.
Yeah, this is Thursday, and she's been detained since Sunday, and yet very little from the corporate media. CBS News finally did come out with a pretty good story, but of course, very late. A newspaper in Iran, I think, has it right. It accuses the United States of engaging in Saudi-style behavior with a critical journalist. And by that, they were comparing the treatment of Hashemi to the Saudis' treatment of their critical journalist, Khashoggi, having chopped up his body at the Turkish consulate, at the Saudi consulate in Turkey. So that's the way the United States looks to other folks in the world, behaving somewhat eerily like the Saudis, their friends.
Exactly. I'm looking at the AP story on this case. Again, we're talking about the arrest of Marzieh Hashemi. We're hearing from her son, who's a student, I believe, at the University of Colorado. We learn now that she's not being charged. Yesterday, we said unspecified charges. Well, guess what, everybody? No charges. Material witness. Here's from a law professor. His name is Ricardo Bascus. He's quoted in the AP story. The constitutionality of the material witness law, quote, has never been meaningfully tested, said this law professor at the University of Miami School of Law. The government, quote, the government only relies on it when they need a reason to arrest somebody, but they don't have one. That's not a legal arrest. I mean, this issue has been meaningfully tested, Glenn Ford. It's called the U.S. Constitution. It's called the Bill of Rights. It's called the Fourth Amendment. The government doesn't have a right to search and seize people and their property without a probable cause. And yet by creating this new category called material witness, somehow the U.S. government says, guess what? The American Constitution doesn't apply to us, the American police state. 1 minute left.
Yes, and this shows how in periods of crisis, whether a conjured and manufactured crisis or not, these kinds of measures, which, as you pointed out, were used to haul in thousands of Arabs or people who looked like Arabs or were thought to be Arabs after 9/11, that these kinds of measures then become part of the toolkit for use at any time by the national security state. Now they're using it against Hashemi, but they're good tools for very bad people.
That's the voice of Glenn Ford. He is the executive director of Black Agenda Report. Glenn Ford, last comment from you. What's the website if people want to read your writings and the other writings at Black Agenda Report?
BlackAgendaReport.com.
Okay, we're going to leave it right there. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. It's time again for our regular weekly segment called Veterans for Peace, where we'll discuss contemporary issues of war and peace that affect veterans, their families, active duty service members, and the country as a whole. We're joined from California by Jerry Condon. Jerry is a Vietnam-era veteran and war resister who has been a peace and solidarity activist for almost 50 years. Currently, Jerry is the national president of the organization called Veterans for Peace. Jerry Condon, welcome back.
Thanks, Brian. Good to be here with you.
This is a really important moment because yesterday in the northern Syrian city of Manbij, four U.S. service members or four U.S. personnel were killed, two service members, one DIA, that's Defense Intelligence Agency member killed, and one contractor. There were 15 other people, Syrians presumably, who died and many, many more who were wounded in a suicide bomb blast. But I have to say the story really in the media today, I'm looking at the New York Times, is less about the bombing itself, less about what happened, that the terrible tragedy that befell those individuals, and more about why this proves that Donald Trump is wrong about withdrawing U.S. troops from Syria. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, well, you know, we're very saddened to hear of all these deaths, including the U.S. soldiers. you know, they're really victims of an unjust, unwise, and illegal U.S. military intervention in Syria. And, you know, some people are understandably suspicious of the timing of these deaths. Right while the U.S. foreign policy establishment is trying to stop President Trump from following through on his promise to pull U.S. troops out of Syria. And, you know, right on cue, all these proponents of U.S. intervention are saying, see, we told you that ISIS is not yet defeated. We need to stay in Syria until they are. But, you know, this is totally skewed logic. It's precisely the U.S. intervention in Syria, its attempt to topple the Syrian government that has created mass terrorism there. Since at least 2012, the U.S. has been providing arms and training to so-called rebel groups in Syria, and many of whom were defeated by or joined up with Al-Qaeda and ISIS, who directly or indirectly received all these U.S. weapons and ammunition. Plus, the U.S. military presence itself in Syria, as in Iraq and Afghanistan, is a magnet for terrorism. So U.S. troops are now sitting ducks in a sea of terrorism created by the U.S. itself.
No, those are important ideas, important words. Jerry Condon is our guest. He's the national president of the organization Veterans for Peace. This is our weekly segment here on Loud and Clear called Veterans for Peace. You know, that's really an important point, and there's different parts of it. I want to unpack it. One is the curious nature of this attack. Manbij in the northern part of Syria was under the control of ISIS, but it's been liberated from ISIS for 2 years. During those 2 years, there hasn't been a single terrorist bombing attack in the last 2 years since ISIS was defeated. These Americans were killed not because they were on patrol against ISIS. They were sitting in a cafe. They were sitting in a cafe where they or other Americans routinely visit and eat or drink coffee or tea. And thus, when the attack happens 2 years after no attack, the immediate crescendo chorus within the Western media, like the New York Times, I'm looking at the headline, ISIS attack in Syria kills 4 Americans, raising new worries about troop withdrawal. I mean, if you were in a U.S. troop in Syria, it would seem to me your immediate reaction to the story would, one, be, hey, leaving would be safer than staying, so they wouldn't be the ones who would be worried. And two, who's the beneficiary? Like when we do an investigation of a murder or a crime or an attack, we have to look at who's the beneficiary. This seems to benefit those who are, you know, finding an argument for, a pretext for continuing U.S. troop presence in Syria.
Right. So, you know, however the bombing may have occurred, and the timing is, as you say, very suspicious in terms of benefiting those who are arguing for the U.S. to stay. But once again, that seems like a crazy argument. Our troops are getting killed. They're sitting in the middle of a sea of terrorism. They're sitting ducks. And therefore, the solution is to keep them there and attract more violence against them? I don't think so. So it's totally skewed logic. It's interesting that the Trump administration so far there's so many mixed messages out there about what's actually happening, but Trump and Pence and others are still saying that they're going to follow through with pulling troops out of Syria. But, you know, even if they do pull the troops out, it's not clear what that's going to mean in terms of continuing U.S. intervention in Syria, because if the U.S. holds on to bases there and continues to use Syrian airspace, there's like over 5,000 private contractors, U.S. contractors in the country, and that's not really a withdrawal from Syria. They seem to be determined to continue to meddle and intervene in Syria in one way or another for some time to come.
The New York Times is favorably reporting about the comments by Senator Lindsey Graham. He's a Republican from South Carolina. He's a right-wing Republican, a pro-Pentagon guy. He gets a lot of money from defense contractors. Perhaps those are the biggest sources of his contributions. He's saying in the Senate, I saw this in Iraq, meaning when Obama withdrew U.S. troops there at the end of 2011. And I'm now seeing it in Syria. He insists that that Trump change his mind to keep the U.S. troops in Syria. But Jerry, again, let's look at the logic here. And this is the point that, you know, is just pushed aside in the mainstream media narrative because they have an agenda, which is to keep American military in Syria. Let's look at the logic. Can 2,000 troops, American troops or any nation's troops, be decisive? Or 2,000 U.S. troops and 5,000 contractors, can they be decisive in a war where the number of combatants numbers in the hundreds of thousands? Of course they cannot be. So American troops in northern Syria are not about decisively stopping ISIS or decisively stopping anything, but they are the pretext for a forward American military presence in a country, a strategic, historically important country in the middle of the Arab world, where the sovereign government, the Syrian government, has not invited these troops to be there, and thus they are there illegally. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to hear you expand on that, because, you know, what is the logic, and why would there be such a universal call? It seems like every major media outlet is, you know, championing Lindsey Graham right now and his words of wisdom, why we have to stay there, why the U.S. troops have to keep on getting killed in Syria and other places. You know, you'd think there would be at least a good debate going on about the wisdom of keeping U.S. troops there, but there's hardly any debate at all. It's across the media. It's like they're all speaking with one voice, and you kind of wonder, like, where is that coming from?
Jerry Condon is our guest. Jerry is the president of the organization Veterans for Peace. This segment of Loud and Clear is called Veterans for Peace. You can hear it every Thursday. Jerry, let's turn to another topic. The government shutdown is now the longest in U.S. history. A lot of federal workers are standing here in Washington, D.C. Well-dressed federal workers are standing in long food lines. That's true. I mean, look at the front page of the New York Times, everyone. See an amazing picture. Again, people are going without paychecks. The idea that federal workers are well-to-do or affluent, well, some may be, but a large number are living paycheck to paycheck. And then there's members of the U.S. Armed Forces, including the Coast Guard, who are not being paid. I saw that guidance set out from the Coast Guard encouraging unpaid Coast Guard members to, if they can't make ends meet, to one, quote, hold a garage sale, or two, start babysitting. I mean, what an insult. And here's the same government that pretends that they love American military personnel. Again, start babysitting, everybody.
Exactly. I mean, we've got 40,000 U.S. Coast Guard personnel who are, you know, carrying out arguably important and often dangerous work on our coasts, and they're not being paid. I mean, one of their wives has now started a GoFundMe page to try to raise money to pay her husband and thousands of other Coast Guard troops. So it's crazy, and you know, there's a lot of veterans affected as well. There's at least 155,000 veterans working at agencies affected by the shutdown, and so they're, you know, their stressful lives where they're still, many of them still dealing with the after effects of having been deployed to war. Now they're having to go without a paycheck. And as we know, so many people in this country do live paycheck to paycheck that it has immediate consequences in their lives. So another instance of where our veterans are getting screwed.
And Jerry, you know, just think about it. Donald Trump condemns football players like Colin Kaepernick who take a knee because they're protesting against violence from the police or racism. And he says they're dishonoring military people when they take a knee. And yet they're not paying Coast Guards members and telling them, yeah, start babysitting, have a garage sale. Anyway, 15 seconds, take us out.
Well, you know, we got a crisis going both with wars abroad and wars at home on our own people, including our own veterans. And I think that, as I said before, 2019 is a year where the chickens are coming home to roost. There are opportunities now for, you know, mass protests against war and mass protests against the unjust domestic policies that oppress so many people here. So Veterans for Peace and many others are going to be stepping up our game this year. It's time to get people into the streets and to call for peace at home and peace abroad.
That's all the time we have. We were joined from California by Jerry Condon. Jerry is a Vietnam-era veteran and war resister. He has been a peace and solidarity activist for almost 50 years. He is currently the national president of Veterans for Peace. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Huawei, the Chinese technology giant, has been targeted in a U.S. criminal probe for alleged theft of trade secrets. Meanwhile, two Democrats and two Republicans introduced a bill yesterday that would ban sales of U.S. technology items like phone chips to Chinese companies ZTE and Huawei. Despite ongoing negotiations between U.S. and Chinese trade officials, the campaign to stop China's economic rise continues. We are joined from San Francisco by David Ewing. He is the chair of the San Francisco chapter of the U.S.-China People's Friendship Association. David Ewing, welcome back.
Thanks. Glad to be back.
Let's talk about this. I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal. Federal prosecutors are pursuing a criminal investigation of China's Huawei Technologies company for allegedly stealing trade secrets from U.S. business partners, including technology used by T-Mobile to test smartphones, according to people familiar with the matter. Let's talk about this case, and then we'll talk about the congressional bill that's been introduced in Congress.
The U.S., of course, has a massive spying program worldwide. And then we always see these allegations that these advances in Chinese technology is somehow always based on technology stolen from the United States. But, you know, in reality, you know, China is actually ahead of the U.S. in a few areas of technology. For example, Huawei company is a world leader in 5G technology, which has the best platform for 5G and is used all over the world already. But allies of the United States and the U.S. are trying to prevent countries from using Huawei technology. So I think in Australia and also in New Zealand, and I think Poland are trying to ban Huawei chips and with the Huawei 5G system. But much of the world, especially countries involved in China's massive Belt and Road Initiative, they're all going to use 5G technology from Huawei because it's the only proven, it's a new technology, but their platform is proven and it's been proven to be reliable.
David Ewing is our guest. I'm looking at the website ZDNet. The article is entitled Bipartisan Bill Introduced to Ban Sale of U.S. Tech to Huawei and ZTE. Again, at the same time as that there's this criminal probe, we have lawmakers from both parties, a bipartisan group, introducing this bill that, if passed, would ban the sale of tech, American technology products, to Chinese companies such as Huawei and ZTE. Let's just go back, David Ewing. In 1978, China announced that it was, quote, opening up, encouraging direct foreign investment in its country, a country with a potentially huge market, potentially the biggest market in the world, because China's population is the biggest in the world, and certainly was then. It also opened up to allow American companies to employ Chinese labor. As a consequence of China being a poorer country, the wages paid to those Chinese workers would be lower than the wages paid to workers in the United States or Western countries. And also the United States would welcome Chinese exports into the U.S. market. That was kind of the quid pro quo. There were other elements of the quid pro quo, too, like joint partnerships, etc. But it feels like we have turned a corner now where China doing trade with the United States, again, the same trade that's been encouraged for the past 40 years, suddenly becomes criminalized. David Ewing, the bill, again, I'm looking at the details of the bill introduced in Congress. They include right-wing Republicans, centrist or liberal Democrats. In other words, it truly is bipartisan. The covered telecommunication companies in the bill, I mean, named companies include Huawei and ZTE. They're both specifically addressed. But other measures included in the bill includes imposing strict penalties originally faced by ZTE on any Chinese company that is found to be in violation of U.S. export control laws or sanctions, ensuring that penalties for violating U.S. export control laws or sanctions are not withdrawn until there is a demonstrated pattern of compliance and cooperation over the course of a year, and disallowing any executive agency official from modifying any penalty imposed on Chinese telecommunications companies unless the president certifies that the company has not violated the U.S. laws. These are very strict standards, very high bars. And let's go back and try to sort of discern what that actually means. Huawei's chief financial officer is still technically in custody in Canada. She was arrested when she got off a plane in Vancouver while she was changing planes. The Canadian government arrested her at the demand of the United States. The United States has now filed extradition papers. And her crime is violating a U.S. law on sanctions against Iran, against a third country. Huawei and the other countries of the world and the other companies that are not American companies, it would seem to me, should not be on any conceivable basis subject to American laws about America's targets in the sanction regime against countries, say, like Iran. So what they're doing is they're arresting Chinese executives who dare to do business with a third country. It's an amazing act of imperial intervention using the law, using American law, to do it.
This sort of sanction regime against political opponents of the United States, this has gone on for decades and decades, though. You remember, before the war with Iraq, there were a whole series of sanctions against foreign countries dealing with Iraq, and it just goes on and on. And this one is so significant, I think, because a good deal of the political focus of this trade war, this most recent measure against China in the trade war, is on Iran. Really, it looks to me as though the U.S. and I think President Trump is moving towards a war against Iran. That seems to be the way the Middle East is shaping up now. Iran's a pretty powerful country, though, and so it's a lot to bite off. But it looks to me like the U.S. is sort of moving in that direction. And then because China does not have a hostile relationship with Iran, and, you know, China needs oil, and Iran has been a source of oil for China. So if you're going to try and cripple China, you need to cut off the oil supply, of course. And I think that's what much of the Middle East wars have been about in the past 20 years, for the U.S. to, even though the U.S. may not need that oil, to control the world oil reserves of the Middle East so they can either turn on or turn off the tap for China. China, though, has moved towards solar energy and other means, nuclear and other means, developing energy. But, you know, I think these kinds of geopolitical factors, especially your mention of Iran, I think is very important. I think that this hostility towards Huawei and ZTE are focused on Iran, because Iran needs a modern, like every other state, needs a modern telecommunications system. The place to get that, of course, is China.
No, that's a really, really important point. It's not simply against China, although China is the target. If Iran is prevented from buying high-tech goods from the West, which obviously it is, the U.S. is imposing the sanctions, but the European allies are acting as complete quislings, even though they don't want the sanctions on Iran. They're going along with it. So where is Iran to go to get technology? Obviously to China, but now Chinese executives and Chinese companies are being either A, arrested, or B, sanctioned for doing trade with Iran. So you're right. David Ewing, you are right. This isn't not only against China, it's also against Iran. 30 seconds left. Obviously, China has other options. They've arrested two Canadian executives. Perhaps that's retaliation for the arrest of the CFO, the chief financial officer of Huawei. Anyway, what do you think China's response will be?
I think China will impose sanctions. You know, China buys 60% of the world's chips. It's going to devastate. I think it will have a very negative impact on American companies that still produce chips. So, you know, a lot are produced in China, of course, but they produce chips in the U.S. still. So they'll retaliate, I suppose, and I think it'll hurt the American economy. The sanctions have had a pretty negative effect so far on steel and everything else that the U.S. produces.
That's the voice of David Ewing. We were talking to David from San Francisco. David is the chair of the San Francisco chapter of the U.S.-China People's Friendship Association. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. This week, mainstream media exploded over meetings between President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Those meetings took place, quote, without a U.S. translator, and in one case, Donald Trump took the notes away from the note taker. But this is not without precedent. We'll take a look at the history of presidential diplomacy. We're joined from Tulsa, Oklahoma by Dr. Jeremy Kuzmarov, a professor of history and the author of the new book, The Russians Are Coming Again. The first Cold War is tragedy, the second as farce. Jeremy Kuzmarov, welcome back.
Thanks. It's great to be here again.
It is a farce. That's the name of part of the title of your book. But I was looking at the New York Times yesterday, and it was a pretty breathless headline. Putin and Trump met five times. What was said between them? It's a mystery. And some of the incidents that they reported were, one, Donald Trump was at a big dinner at a long table. Putin was at one end. Trump was at the other. There were lots of other people around. Melania Trump was there. But at one moment, Donald Trump stopped at the end of the table and spoke for a moment with Vladimir Putin, and there wasn't a note taker around. But there were other instances where Donald Trump took the notes away from the note taker. Anyway, is this a big deal? Because at least in the U.S. media, it's being treated as maybe evidence that, in fact, Vladimir Putin is giving Donald Trump secret instructions when other people aren't around to listen.
That's exactly what these kind of articles are insinuating. And as I've said before, it's almost like out of the John Birch Society accusation. You know, the insinuation is that Trump is some kind of Manchurian candidate and that Putin is manipulating him. That's a kind of underlying theme that comes out of so many of these articles. And really, it's more routine diplomacy. You know, the United States leaders have had summits with Russian leaders for years, you know, going back to the Roosevelt administration and the famous Yalta summits. So, you know, they're making a mountain out of a molehill. I mean, it's routine diplomacy, and it's something positive if a U.S. leader is meeting his Russian counterparts, but they're presenting it in a way that would insinuate that Trump is a kind of Manchurian candidate.
Yeah, so let's talk about whether this is unprecedented, because it's being presented. Everything Donald Trump is doing is being presented as unprecedented. Everything. But I was doing a little bit of research. It doesn't seem that unprecedented to me.
No, it's not. And there have been some articles and some research done on this that, you know, Richard Nixon, because he had some, you know, he had some problems with the State Department. There was some mistrust that had developed. So he was doing what Trump is doing now, is that he was speaking with foreign leaders, yeah, including Brezhnev, without translators. And it was often just Nixon and Kissinger speaking, and they weren't reporting exactly what they were saying. Now, I don't think that's necessarily a great precedent, because Nixon was a very sneaky leader, very undemocratic. You know, he was doing some devious things. But nevertheless, I think the media is blowing this way out of proportion, and they should be focused on some other aspects of Trump's presidency that are much more disturbing than this.
Yeah, and Nixon at times didn't have the American translator present in the Oval Office when he was meeting one-on-one with Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev. And he explained that the reason he didn't want others in the room was he felt, quote, Brezhnev would be more comfortable with fewer people. He knew his translator, and also Nixon thought the Soviet translator, who he knew from previous experiences, was an excellent translator, an excellent linguist. Again, if you apply those standards to now, Donald Trump would be proof positive, in fact, that Donald Trump is the Manchurian candidate.
Exactly. And I mean, I think that there are some, you know, routine aspects of diplomacy here that leaders naturally sometimes do want to get away and just have a conversation on their own. I mean, I don't think they're necessarily obligated to report everything they say. I mean, that's, you know, part of cultivating any kind of relationship. So, again, I think the media is blowing this way out of proportion, and the inferences are what's disturbing.
Jeremy Kuzmarov is our guest. Jeremy, I'm looking back at a Reuters story. It comes from March 26, 2012. The headline is, Obama tells Russia's Medvedev more flexibility after the election. I want to read a little bit from that article. This is 2012. Medvedev was then the president of Russia, meaning he was the head of state. Putin at that time was prime minister. Of course, Medvedev and Putin are very close historically, politically. Here's what the article says. President Barack Obama was caught on camera on Monday assuring outgoing Russian President Dmitry Medvedev that he will, quote, have more flexibility, close quote, to deal with contentious issues like the missile defense shield after a U.S. presidential election. Obama, during talks in Seoul, urged Moscow to, quote, give him, quote, space, close quote, until after the November ballot. That would be in November 2012. And Medvedev said he would relay the message to incoming Russian President Vladimir Putin. The unusually frank exchange came as Obama and Medvedev huddled together on the eve of a global nuclear security summit in South Korea, unaware that their words were being picked up by microphones as reporters were led into the room. Here's what he said. As he was leaning towards Medvedev in Seoul, Obama was overheard on this mic, open mic, asking for time, quote, particularly with missile defense, close quote, until he was in a better position politically to resolve issues. Quote, I understand your message about space, close quote, replied Russian President Medvedev, who will hand over the presidency, this article says, to Putin in May. Quote, here's Obama. Listen to this. This is my last election. After my election, I have more flexibility. And then Medvedev says, okay, I will transmit this information to Vladimir, close quote. Can you imagine if Trump was heard on an open mic that he thought was a closed mic talking like that? Can you imagine what the response would be?
I think, yeah, the response would be outrageous. But I think, I think the media is focused right now on what is just routine diplomatic discussions among leaders who may want a bit of privacy, which would be normal. Whereas, in that case, I mean, there's a clear sense of, him reporting to somebody else, but you don't have that at all with Trump. So they haven't found anything of that nature with Trump.
You know, there was other parts of the historical precedent. Let's talk about what actually happened between Nixon and Mao Zedong, for instance. I mean, China was on the number one enemy in American foreign policy for a long time. The U.S. wouldn't allow China to sit in the Security Council after the October 1949 revolution. Instead, the rump government in Taiwan was given the Security Council seat. So it was Chiang Kai-shek's government. Absolute, unmitigated China. When we heard about China in the media, it was called Red China. It wasn't called the People's Republic of China. In order to have a new relationship, a better relationship with China, given the delicacy of doing that, Nixon dispatched Kissinger to China, where they had secret diplomacy between Kissinger and Zhou Enlai, the premier of China, and also Mao Zedong, the historic leader of the Chinese Communist Party. They met in secret. And then Nixon went to Peking, what was then called Peking, now Beijing, and had meetings. And when they met with Mao, it was only Nixon and Kissinger, the two, you know, conspirators for the new foreign policy who were in the room. Again, under the current standards, the ones being applied to Trump meeting with Putin, they too would be, you know, basically accused of treason.
Absolutely. And also, I mean, Obama, there was a lot of back channel diplomacy that went on with Cuba to restore, you know, better diplomatic relations between the United States and Cuba under the Obama administration. Nobody would insinuate that was treason. I mean, most see that as a positive, that the United States today has much better relations with Cuba. So just like the example you're pointing out, I mean, I think that's the nature of the business. You know, there is, of course, most of us would like to see more transparency, but in some circumstances, there is necessity for some secrecy and for some, you know, personal relations to be cultivated to advance a relationship. In the case of the United States and Russia today, it seems there's been very limited opportunity for that. I mean, they're picking on some incidents that amount to almost nothing. I mean, many of us, I think, would like to see more elaborate efforts by the Trump administration to try and cultivate a better relationship with Putin, but that's impossible in this climate.
You know, Jeremy Kuzmarov, I want to also mention, I'm just looking at an article. It's from March 2016. It's in on the media website Signature, the 9 secret meetings it took to resume U.S.-Cuban relations. It goes through the history of U.S.-Cuban secret diplomacy before Obama finally, after some of these secret meetings, was able to consummate a deal whereby the U.S., after 54 years of not having an embassy in Havana, opened one, and likewise, Cuba opened an embassy not far from where we are here in Washington, D.C. Again, yes, open diplomacy would be preferred so that the people of the world can know what's going on, but the ways of the world are such that secret discussions are routine. And yet here, even when Donald Trump spends 2 minutes or 30 seconds with Putin talking on the sidelines, the New York Times and others, again, sound the alarm. There's a mystery going on. Why? 30 seconds left, 45 seconds. What's behind all this?
I think it's an underlying agenda that there are certain interests in the United States, you know, connected to the U.S. military complex, who see Putin as too nationalistic, too independent, and want to undermine his government, and also want a rationale to maintain very high levels of military spending. So they're creating a hysterical environment that will make a detente impossible. And that's a tragedy in light of some of the examples you're pointing out, where the United States had these traditional adversaries, but was able, through effective diplomacy, sometimes in secret, to forge better relations. And the world is a better place, I think, because of that. In the case of, you know, U.S.-Cuba, U.S.-China, for years, that was a positive relationship. Unfortunately, now that's also deteriorating. But the world was more stable when the U.S. and China were having, you know, good relations.
Well, that's all the time we have. We were joined from Tulsa, Oklahoma, by Dr. Jeremy Kuzmarov. He is a professor of history and the author of the new book, The Russians Are Coming Again, The First Cold War as Tragedy, The Second as Farce. Be sure to look for that book. We are out of time. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. And you can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.